Welcome to the Joy of Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Dr. James Taylor. On this podcast, we explore the passion and purpose of leadership. Join us to explore lessons in leadership that demonstrate how you can live in the center of God's will. All right, Sebastian, Dr. Sebastian Verduva, it's great to have you on the show today. I'm really excited to dig into your story. To see all that God is doing. You are leaping into some subjects that I'm particularly excited about. But how about before we jump there, I would love to just kind of hear your personal story, Romania, U.S., to see how that story kind of has played out in your life. So welcome. Thank you, and let us know a little bit about your story.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for letting me be with you. It is wonderful. Congratulations for everything that you've done here, along with wonderful people, the great team that is involved in this. Christian education is near and dear to my heart, right. So blessings to you.
Thank you so much. Keep on keeping on. Thank you.
So I was born and raised in Romania in the dark days of communism.
Right.
This is a time when there was just abject poverty and an atheistic system. I was born in a large family with six kids and an alcoholic father. So things weren't really all that good, both because it was communism and because of our own personal situation. Then in 1989, I was age 12, my family emigrated to the United States, and this was before the Berlin Wall fell, so there was still communism. We came to America and landed in Chicago in April of 89,
and the whole family,
three sisters stayed behind, and me and my two brothers came to my father. So my father escaped in 1986, and then we came in 1989. So he was here 3 years before us. When we got to America, we thought we reached the promised land. Right. I mean, we landed in Chicago. We saw the lights. We saw the food. We saw the wonderful prosperity. And literally, it was really heaven on earth, so to say. Unfortunately, 3 months later, our father left us. So we were right back, kind of like where we started. We moved to Cleveland, Ohio, in the inner city of Cleveland. Lived on some makeshift beds for a couple of weeks till we sort of got our sea legs, so to say. And that's when I kind of became an entrepreneur. And the summer of 1989, just to survive, I started going door to door. Couldn't speak a word of English. I could only say the word work, you know, and asking people to let me work for them.
And how old were you at
that point? 12. I was 12 at the time. Yeah, and I did everything that I could have. You know, I cut grass. I did roofing. You know, in the summer, the winter came, I shoveled the snow because it was, you know, Ohio. I ended up working at a meat shop. Sort of as a cleaning boy. And that's where my entrepreneurship career really took off. 4 years later, I bought out the guy that I was working for. I was 17. I was 17 at the time. I paid $25,000 with a loan in my mother's name because I was not legal to sign any papers or to do anything. Later, I became legally emancipated. My mom couldn't speak any English, so she just sort of signed on the dotted line. And it was just a very interesting ride of kind of living the American dream, working very hard and reaping some of the fruits of those labor. Unfortunately, I entered a period of rebellion. My mother was and is a good Christian, but because of my father, because of what had happened with this transition from Romania into America, I was just didn't want anything to do with God, didn't want anything to do with Romania. So I was very, very much against it all. And then interestingly, God reached my heart through a television documentary, Barbara Walters' 2020, The Shame of a Nation. It was an episode about the plight of the Romanian orphans. So there I was on a Friday night just looking at these orphan kids and the situation that they had. And I was feeling sorry for myself that our father left us, that I had to work hard and so on and so forth. And it's as though I heard the whisper of the Lord saying, stop feeling sorry for yourself. Look at those kids.
Right.
By comparison, you're doing well. You know, you're in the greatest country on earth. You have a bunch of opportunities. You learn the language. People starting to like you. You have customers. You know, your business is going well. Stop feeling sorry for yourself. And I gave my life to the Lord then and there. And not only did I give my...
In a Barbara Walters special.
In a Barbara Walters special, if you can imagine it.
So never have I heard that story
there
before.
You go. Wow. There you go. So God can use, the Holy Spirit can use any means, you know, to bring people back to Him. You know, so I, you know, I went back to church, and again, it wasn't that I wasn't going to church. I was going to the sure. The Romanian church in Cleveland, but I just had this rebellious spirit. And then and there, I gave my life to the Lord. And not only did I accept Him as my Savior, but also as my Lord. And I said, Lord, if You want me to go back, you know, I'm willing to do that. You know, go back to those orphan kids. And I tell my students, be careful what you promise God, because He may hold you to it. And He certainly held me to it. But God was more than faithful. If in 1989 I was on the streets of inner city Cleveland, by 1999 I was an instructor at the University of Akron, one of their youngest professors. Finished my MBA with an entrepreneurship concentration. This was the dot-com boom, you know. I was supposed to be a McKinsey consultant, so they were talking about me going to the West Coast and do valuations of the tech startups. You know, this was the AOL period with Yahoo and everybody else. And I think I would have probably ended up in China as one of the executives to sort of open China for the tech industry. But God had a different plan, and God said, well, you made me a promise, so I'm going to hold you to it. And through a series of events in the summer of 1999, I ended up at the University of Akron. And shortly thereafter, I received a State Department grant where I did my first PhD in entrepreneurship, and I was able to go back to Emmanuel University. So Emmanuel University was actually started in the 1980s by the Second Baptist Church of Oradea, now it's Emmanuel Baptist. And this was a church that stood up to the communist regime and wouldn't, you know, because it was illegal for Christians to be educated.
Right.
You know, we didn't have any Christian education. So they started an underground training program called the School of the Prophets, you know. And throughout the 80s, they were just training people for the church. Then in the 1990s, when the wall fell and communism kind of dissipated, they brought the school above ground and they registered it. And as they went and talked to the prime minister said, why do you want to limit yourself just to a theological seminary? Why not do a full-blown university where you can actually train professionals? And they're going to be your missionaries and they're going to be our professionals.
Was the prime minister a believer?
No, he wasn't.
He wasn't. So he just, wasn't. From a business perspective, he was seeing the value of it.
Exactly. He was a pragmatic. Okay. And he saw the level of corruption that was around, the level of decrepitness. He saw what atheism did to that region. He saw that socialism doesn't work, that when government gets involved, it's corruption and low quality stuff. So he saw this beacon of light on the other side of the country, because he was in Bucharest and you know, the university was in Oradea, which is about 550 kilometers away. So he saw that and he said, you guys may have something. You know, you may be able to do something. So that's how Emmanuel University got started. Initially, it was just a theological school that had social assistance, music, had some pedagogy programs. And then in the 1995, 96, the thought was for a business school, a marketplace missions, something that would train business missionaries, visionaries we call them. And I knew about this, but I was doing my thing at the University of Akron. So the Lord used a number of individuals from Great Britain. Lord Brian Griffiths, John Lenton was the founding dean. So for a number of years, he moved from Great Britain to Romania and established the school. Then by the late 90s, early 2000s, we sort of reconnected, you know. And I remember the president and the founder of the university that came to the University of Akron and said, Sebastian, would you consider moving back to Romania? And my answer in a very godly way was absolutely not. I mean, I just got this position at the University of Akron. I was 23. I mean, I had my whole life ahead of me. But then God started nudging on my heart and said, well, remember the promise you made me? And I said, okay, I'm willing to do it sort of part-time. And then part-time turned into full-time. And by 2004, I became a Fulbright scholar, worked for the U.S. Embassy in Republic of Moldova. And then in 2005, I finished my PhD and moved back permanently. My main responsibility was just was to get the school accredited. So the university was accredited, but the business program wasn't. And as a university, we were seeking government accreditation so we can keep our doors open, because this is Europe. So under socialism, you're not allowed to do anything unless the government gives the stamp of approval. And we did it through God's grace. First, we did the Romanian accreditation, and then we got the European Union accreditation. 2005 was also a great year, because that's when I married my wife. So she is from Romania. So we've known each other, you know, being in the same church. And she is and was a great helper to me as I transitioned back, because it was a struggle, mm-hmm. you know, going back from America, from the University of Akron, where you had a large university with, you know, 26,000 students and, you know, budgets and things like that. And here you are in a struggling school, right. you know,
startup,
and you're starting a business program right. And where a lot of people are looking at you and saying, you know, what is that? You know, how can you combine business with the Bible? You know, how can you get jobs for these people? How can you get professors? So it seemed like we had a struggle at every step of the way, you know, mm-hmm. In those early years, I would describe our experience kind of like the opening scene in Saving Private Ryan. You know, you would get at the beaches and they would open those things and the Germans would be shooting right. at you. And that's the feeling that I would have, that right. there were bullets coming from every which way. And we realized then, and I still realize now, that that's really the front lines in the spiritual war for Europe. Because unfortunately, Europe has become very secular.
Right.
There's very little Christian
largely
witness.
Godless. Yeah.
Yeah. You have very few churches, and the mm-hmm. ones that are, unfortunately, are turning into museums. So I realized the task that we had, mm-hmm. and even when the Lord allowed us to join the European Union, and that was a big hubbub. You know, we're going to get into it. There's going to be bureaucracy, so on and so forth. We as a university saw that as an opportunity, mm-hmm. and it's God enlarging our territory and saying, well, you used to train people for the Eastern world, you know, mm-hmm. the former mm-hmm. Soviet world. Now you're going to train people for the Western world.
Right.
So we're very grateful for that opportunity, so but it's also a burden.
Let's dig deep into the model that Emmanuel has really stepped into, which I think is really visionary. I also feel like in a world that is becoming increasingly post-Christian, right. not just, you know, certain geographic regions, the model that Emmanuel has put forth, I think, is honestly on the front of the wave
right.
For the impact of the gospel. So there at Emmanuel, every student is a theology major, and they're also doing other degrees, right? So walk people through just like what the philosophy is there at Emmanuel, and what is then the gospel impact from that?
Right. So every student has to have a minimum of one theology class.
Right.
Typically, they have about three. So okay. one formal, one informal, and then they have to have some sort of a service. Mm-hmm. So every student does that. Now, the theology students, they have just theology because sure. they're preparing for the ministry, right. for the pastorate. Their degree is also 4 years. Everybody else's is three okay. because that's the European system. So first of all, there is the formal curriculum that they have to have it. Second of all, we as professors, we weave our faith within the material that we teach.
Right.
So for instance, in the business program, we just completed a 12 textbook project where we have written 12 textbooks from a Christian perspective. Now, again, we use a lot of material that was written by other people, mm-hmm. but in the Romanian language, there isn't such a thing.
Sure.
So we had to develop that curriculum. So oftentimes we lead by example.
Right.
The other thing that we do, and this is especially in the business school, is we're always looking for opportunities to be salt and light. So right. we are using the open doors that God has around us so we can share the gospel, so we can overlap between the need that the world has and the things that we believe in as Christians. So for instance, there's an organization, maybe some of our listeners have heard about it, Transparency International. This is the largest global organization that does anti-corruption things.
Okay.
So they have a chapter in Romania, and I joined their board. I was invited to join on their board, and together with them, we did a caravan. We literally went to about 15 or 20 cities, and we talked about integrity. And they were talking about integrity from the perspective of the social issues. We were talking about it from the gospel perspective. So we had an opportunity to interact with a lot of secular individuals and present our point of view. We even did a video, and the video had over 300,000 views on the merits of integrity and how integrity generates prosperity. And that was our thing. Mm-hmm. And we made a correlation between poor nations and corrupt nations. And in contrast, you have wealthy nations and very ethical nations or more ethical nations. And that was a message that was very well received. Mm-hmm. Recently, we just launched a journal, the Journal of Ethics in Entrepreneurship and Technology. Same idea behind it.
Do you have the freedom then to really speak into the source of your integrity?
Absolutely.
So you do. So you get real gospel freedom.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
Fascinating.
So our model, and again, this is biblical. You know, our model is Daniel from the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. So when you look at Daniel, Daniel ended up in Babylon, which was a very hostile environment, mm-hmm. right? I mean, here's an empire that has desolated Jerusalem, killed half the population, including most likely Daniel's parents. Mm-hmm. And then Daniel ends up being an employee, a government employee in the palace of Nebuchadnezzar. Yet Daniel's there as an excellent person. So Daniel chapter 1, verse 20, 19 and 20 says that in all the things that the king asked, he was 10 times better. Mm-hmm. Daniel and his friends were 10 times better than their colleagues. And then Daniel chapter 1, verse 8 is Daniel deciding not to defile himself.
That's right.
And this is exactly our model. That's why our motto of the university is integrity, excellence, and passion. Mm-hmm. And that's you see that from Daniel. Mm-hmm. Daniel chapter 1, verse 8 is the integrity. 19 and 20 is the excellency. And then Daniel chapter 9 is the passion, where he really feels for his people. He prays. He asks for forgiveness. So Daniel was a tremendous professional, a public administrator. I tell my students in Hebrews chapter 11, the men and women that God has used in the past, majority of them were entrepreneurs. Some of them were politicians, were public administrators. These were great professionals that were doing a real good job solving real life problems. And as they were doing that, they had an opportunity to share the gospel. Mm-hmm. Every so often you see Daniel at the most critical times that he stands up and says, actually, I don't have the wisdom. God has the wisdom. Mm-hmm. Actually, there's a God who created heaven and earth. And you, by the way, king, I mean, you see the way he confronts Nebuchadnezzar.
Right.
My goodness, that's gutsy.
Right.
But he had the professional platform to do that
right.
because he had been in the king's service for such a long time. He was respected. Everybody took his advice seriously. And that's the model that we're trying to implement in our students.
Like very much of a matter of fact faith. I find that so often people who are Christians, there's such a compartmentalization
in
their
faith.
That's
what it is,
right?
Yeah.
And so that they're saying, oh, well, this is my business role.
Yeah.
And now here's my dad role.
Right.
And now here's my Christian role. And that happens on Sunday between the hours of 9 and 11.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And so there's this compartmentalization. And in doing so, what I find is, one, we lose our impact, but two, we also lose our joy.
Exactly.
Like there's such joy in being a component. You know, you're mentioning Daniel, one of my favorite verses in Daniel, when the other powers that be have tricked the king into signing the edict
right,
that he'll be accused. And I love that it says that he goes back to his house, he opens up his windows, he kneels to pray, just as he always had.
Exactly.
And I love that phrase, that his faithfulness was not contingent upon his circumstances, that instead he is jumping in and he's being faithful because he has been habitually faithful.
Exactly.
Christ has been proven, God has been proven faithful in his life, and he knows that he can continue to be faithful to God. That's such a message that our young leaders must have.
Absolutely.
You know, and you've done a lot with the idea of the development of leaders, coaching leaders, really helping define who they are. Tell us kind of, what are some of the hallmarks of how you're preparing young leaders for senior roles and how to remain gospel-centered in those roles?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So the first one's actually easier. The second one is proving to be more difficult. And I recently wrote a book. It's only in Romanian. I'm going to translate it in English, Lord willing, called The Trademarks and Temptations. Mm. Of successful people.
Okay.
And we've identified, here's the seven trademarks, but also pay attention to the temptation. So I think that trademarks, the way you develop the leaders is through personal example and through giving them opportunities.
Okay.
Kind of like pushing them.
Right.
Oftentimes, especially in our context, people are kind of down on themselves. Well, you know, I'm a Christian, I'm a poor boy, I shouldn't get into this, you know. So people need to be pushed from behind and say, hey, you can do it. Go to that job interview, assume that position, take out that business loan, you know, go for that. There's a lot of contests in order for them to get different positions. Don't be afraid of that. Go to the business plan competitions, do it. And very often, I tell them kind of like from the Old Testament when Elisha was telling the king of taking the bow and arrows and to draw as many arrows as possible. Don't stop after three times. Just keep on doing and keep on doing and keep on doing. Because if you prepare and if you work hard enough, God's going to come alongside you and help you. Mm-hmm. And the big distinction between a secular leader and a business leader is we as Christian leaders, we are not responsible for the outcomes. We're responsible for the faithfulness.
That's right.
1 Corinthians 3:6, Paul says that I planted, Apollo waters, God makes it grow.
That's right.
So I tell my people, don't worry about failure. Your objective should not be to avoid failure. Your objective should be to be faithful.
That's
so
right.
If God's calling you to plant something, to water something, mm-hmm. go do it. And if you have to do it 5 different times, go do it 5 different times. In due course, God will bring the results. Trust in that.
That's right.
Trust in that. So that's part of our leadership development in terms of encouraging them, in terms of equipping them, exposing them to opportunities, to individuals, to models, around it. On the second part, it proves to be a little more difficult. How do you maintain that? And the key word there is accountability. And unfortunately, in our culture, we don't have that well established yet, where people give an account of their life, where people...
You're saying Romanian culture or Christian culture?
Romanian culture, okay. But also in Christian culture. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm looking at the disasters that we've had in the last mm-hmm. 5 to 10 years mm-hmm. on well-known Christian leaders that have fallen apart. And you're asking yourself, what's going on? Mm-hmm. Where were those boards? Where were their close friends? Mm-hmm. That keep watch on them. So maybe it's me personally this is my prayer for my life, mm-hmm. but especially for my students, is God, don't only grow them, but keep them.
I think the Christian community has not been immune to being enamored by stardom.
Right.
And I think that, you could look at Hollywood and you see kind of the depravity that takes place, and we hear about different situations like Weinstein and some different things like this. We see the depravity there that we've forgiven up to a certain point because of stardom.
Right.
I don't think the Christian community has become immune to that. When we see some of these famous men, and it's almost always men, when we see the idea of these famous Christian men who have fallen, and afterwards we're all scratching our head, but the issue is there is still an essence of stardom.
Right.
And in there, you stop being held accountable.
That's what it is.
That when you start believing your own story, when you start believing your own fame, mm-hmm. then there's a depreciation of humility in our lives. The key verse that I try very hard to make sure that every facet of my life comes from Philippians 2:3. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in all things consider others before yourself. And I think that, you're a senior leader, I'm a senior leader. There are people who are often telling, oh, you're so great.
Right.
Oh, boy, I love this book. Boy, you're making such. And I think it's so easy for senior leaders to begin to believe that.
Exactly.
Rather than to recognize our humility at the feet of God.
Right.
And that should drive where we go. Is there a way then that you are helping young leaders to make sure that they have a process of accountability in their lives?
So the first thing is that I acknowledge it.
Right.
Because I see a lot of, especially young, promising Christian leaders, they think that's never going to happen to mm-hmm, them. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, it can happen to anybody.
Right.
So keep watch.
Right.
So it's an issue. And in my book, I'm doing the parallel between David and King Saul.
Love that.
So King Saul is sort of my negative model. And I'm saying, here's a person who was called by God, who did wonderful things early on, but because he started believing his own press, mm-hmm.
Right.
Because he thought he knew better than God, because he tried to manipulate Samuel the prophet, God cast him away. So beware of that. So I think the first step is to just remind them that they're only human. Mm-hmm. And remind them that, hey, listen, this can happen to anybody. The second issue is for them to establish the system. Mm-hmm. And the first system is our friends around them.
Sure.
To be accountable to their own wives, to go to church regularly, not to think that they're above the church, to have uncomfortable people in their lives mm-hmm. that ask them the tough questions, whether it's in their personal walk or their financial walks on things like that, and just have those transparent conversations, what oftentimes are uncomfortable.
That's right.
But
we have to model that.
That's exactly right. Right. Yeah. So what I tell them, I said, when you get together, and I think this is one of the mistakes that Christians fall into, we have this notion that when we get together, it should all be joy. Mm-hmm. It should all be fun. It should just be nice celebration. And you see this on Sunday. You see this when we're having a fellowship or something right. like that. Now, please don't get me wrong. I am not against having sweet fellowship.
Absolutely.
It's right. It's wonderful.
Right.
But if, you know, in the duration of a year, you've only had sweet fellowship That's and everything right. felt great and everything was like a show and everything was very well orchestrated. And nobody talked about the difficult pieces. Mm-hmm. Nobody asked the tough questions. Nobody confessed the failure and said, listen, I lost my temper with my kid.
Yeah.
You know, I was not what I was supposed to be with my neighbors. You know, so on and so forth. If there's never any of that, I'm starting to ask myself, you know, is it really not there? Which I don't believe so. I think it's there. Or people just don't talk about it.
Yeah.
So I think we have to have the culture
right.
where that's acceptable.
I think with men, so often we have a lot of acquaintances, mm-hmm. but we have very few Christian friends.
Exactly.
There's a loneliness, which I suspect is the same in Romania as it sure. is in the U.S. There's a loneliness among leaders, like male leaders. We don't necessarily find those friendships and affinities. You know, I teach a men's group here on Friday mornings. And that's one of the things that we talk about all the time is that for us to be able to be held accountable, for us to hold others accountable, we have to also be willing to be accountable.
Exactly.
When I look back and I see the guys in my life who have made the biggest impact, my closest Christian friends, I recognize there's one thing in common, and I could count, you know, there's really four guys in my life that I could really say I count on them. You know, in all four of those situations, we have each called each other out.
Exactly.
So that we've had to say, whoa, 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 whoa. You can't yeah. treat your wife that way.
That's right.
Hold on.
Yeah.
You're applying a business practice that's a secular business practice and you're a Christian man. That's not appropriate. And so when you have that ability to call people out, isn't it something though that we have to build into our lives? Like mm-hmm. I've got to search for that.
Exactly. Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
We as senior leaders, we could be so busy doing really good things, making really good impacts,
right.
and yet we stop modeling this idea for the young leaders who are watching.
Exactly.
They're watching our lives.
Exactly, exactly. Know? Yeah, and that's what I tell my senior guys. First of all, don't pretend like you have no struggles, like everything is hunky-dory, mm-hmm. like everything is rosy, because it's not. Second of all, open yourself up for periodic check-ins.
That's right.
You know?
That's right.
Because if you don't have that, sooner or later, you'll be vulnerable.
Right.
Sooner or later, you'll do, you know, what David did of having an evening alone and watching what you're mm-hmm. not supposed to watch, going where you're not supposed to go.
Right.
Prevent those things so you can maintain. The other thing that I increasingly tell people, and this is probably because my age, I keep telling people you are the most effective in your ministry in the last 20 years of your life.
Yes.
You know, after
totally
you
agree.
After you marry off your kids, you right. know, you have the freedom, you have the wisdom, hopefully you have some financial independence. Yeah. That's when you can do the most for the kingdom.
I completely agree.
But I see lots of people that are discrediting themselves.
Yes.
Either because they don't live a healthy life
mm-hmm.
or because they fall into sin or yeah. because they have, you know, kids that are going away. And instead of rejoicing in the old age, being patriarchs, mm-hmm. this is what I think the kingdom of God needs.
Mm-hmm.
We need those patriarchs that can lead us into the promised
right.
land.
Right.
You know, instead of having those individuals, we have people who are giving all kinds of explanations. Well, this didn't happen and that didn't happen. Well, I could have, but that particular board didn't appreciate me and that particular organization. Well, maybe you should have done things differently.
Right.
Maybe if you wouldn't have rushed things.
Right.
And that's, again, I'm going back to Saul. I think that was the biggest temptation that he had. Because if you look in the scripture, you know, he's prepared for battle. And God's telling him, listen, wait till Samuel comes to bring the burnt offering. And people are putting pressure because Samuel is 5 days late.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is bad. You know, the Philistines are across the valley. And Saul is saying to himself, you know, I'm not going to wait for the Lord. You know, I'm going to do things my own mm-hmm, way mm-hmm. because you know what? The end justifies the means.
That's
you
right.
know, we got a battle. You know, I'm going to bring the sacrifice because I'm supposed to, but I'm going to do it my own way. And I think this is just such a, just a hubris temptation with a lot of men leaders
yeah.
that they know better.
Yeah.
They're going to give God a hand.
Yeah.
And you see throughout the scripture, you know, Abraham wanted to help God out with the promise and, you know, say, all right, I'm going to figure out somebody to inherit me. And that's how you have Ishmael. So you have to be willing to lose. This is what I tell my people. Be willing to lose. Be willing to walk away from a big deal. Mm-hmm. Walk away from a wonderful opportunity. And let God be the one that brings it into your life. In contrast, I love what David says to Joab as they're fleeing from Absalom. And Joab wants to kill Shimei and says, you know, my lord, you know, we lost the kingdom today. We had all kinds of troubles. Mm-hmm. Let me at least feel good.
Right.
let me kill this dog.
Yeah.
And he says something so wonderful. He says, what do I have with you? If God told him to curse me, it's God's problem. Mm-hmm. Let God bring me back.
That's right.
God made me a king once. God can make me a king again. And that's what I tell my Christian leaders. Who has built that business? Is mm-hmm. it you or God? Who has given you that ministry? Is it you or God?
You know, one of the biggest travesties that I see among Christian businessmen and women is that they'll reach a level of success. And I'm not sure whether this is true in Romania. It's very true here in the U.S., they'll reach a level of success and their goal becomes, I'm going to retire at 45 or I'm going to retire at 50.
Right.
And you know, we just talked about the idea the most effective years of your life are probably 50 to 70.
Right.
You know, yep. Like those are, you have wisdom, you have some stability that you haven't had. You can speak to parenting roles because you've done it. You can speak to sure. marital roles because yeah. you've done it, yeah. hopefully done it well. Yeah. But I watch men and women, they're cashing in their chips.
Yep.
Right when they are the most effective for the kingdom. And then they become professional hobbyists.
That's right.
You know, that they
play golfing. They're
like, that's not meant to be your job. It's meant to be a hobby,
that's
you
right.
know?
That's right.
And man, now they've lost their effectiveness in literally the most effective two decades of your life.
Exactly.
And that's where I feel like it's so important. And frankly, why I love Emmanuel in what you guys are doing is that we try to, and we do the same here, same thing here at Hebron. We want our parents, we want our students to understand when you have a calling, whatever that calling is, whether it's to be a dentist or a neurosurgeon
right.
or a lawyer or a business owner or a pastor or a teacher, that when we're called into it, then our career is no longer ours.
Right.
That the trajectory of our path, the trajectory of our walk is being guided by our Creator. And there's no expiration date on
exactly.
that, right? Exactly. There's no, hey, at 62, I can cash out a little bit early. Maybe if I'm really successful, it's 45 or 50.
Right.
You know, I mean, we see the best Christian influences we see. There's no retirement. You're going to keep going until yep. God takes you home.
Yep.
You know?
Absolutely. What I see, and actually it may be a Romanian situation, but I think it's also in America. I think it's a spirit of self-indulgence.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Sort of like, well, you know what? I sacrificed right. it. And right. I write about this in my book. You know, right. people that are hard workers, determined, yep. they have grit, that, you yep. know, they sacrifice 30 years, you know, build a business, build a practice, build a church. And then they're like, you know what? Enough.
Yeah.
You know? And that's exactly what got David into trouble.
Right.
You know,
it is.
He was supposed to go to battle. He was supposed to lead his people. And then people around him said, well, you know what? Take it easy. Mm-hmm. You know, you've done enough. Take it easy. Kick back. Now, again, I am not against taking a well-deserved rest.
Me
you know?
Too.
So sabbaticals right. are great. But if you look in the scriptures, sabbaticals are not supposed to be times that you do absolutely nothing.
That's right.
But rather, you fill your soul, you That's fill right. your mind, you read a book, you write a book,
right.
you know, so you change activities, but doesn't mean that you indulge.
Right.
And I think that's the big temptation.
There needs to be work-life balance.
Exactly.
But that also means there needs to be work.
That's exactly right. right. So, again, we have this culture around us. We have a number of companies and organizations mm-hmm. that are trying to sell us, you know, right. the timeshares, the vacations, the right. golf clubs, the, you know, the convertible car. Mm-hmm. And you're like, that's what it's about. No, it's not.
Right.
Especially for Christians. Our reward is in heaven.
That's
Our
right.
reward is not at retirement,
right.
you know.
Right.
Retirement is the time when we are the elders of the city,
right.
of the community. That's when we're supposed to give the most. That's when we're supposed to be role models. That's when we're supposed to teach. That's when we're supposed to invest into other people, mm-hmm. not for us to kick back and,
right.
and sort of show the other people around. That was a movie, and we marketing professors are Keeping Up with the Joneses.
Mm-hmm.
Which was just a terrible movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it had this undertone of where I'm going to entice people. You know, so there's this unit that's going into a rich suburbia, and it's enticing people with all the goodies that they have.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they got this beautiful house, they got this beautiful car. And I think that's a huge temptation mm-hmm. for successful people to allow themselves to be used. as, well, you know, all you're supposed to do is entice people. You know, right. Go work hard and you two are going to have a wealthy car, or yeah. You two are going to have a big house, so on and so forth. We're supposed to be using the tools around us so we can invest in people, so we can invest in kingdom. There's so much work to be done here in the U.S. and throughout the world. The global population is poised to reach 10 billion people within our lifetime.
Unbelievable.
That's huge.
Yeah.
And most of these people are going to be born in places like Africa, Asia, South America, you know. And we have a responsibility to whom much is given, much is required. Mm-hmm. You know, if we are successful, if we were able to build a business, if we are neurosurgeons, or if we are, we have a responsibility towards this global population that literally, in the words of Yuval Noah Harari, could be a useless generation. I think that's the devil's plan.
Sure.
To look at these people, you know, if it wasn't able to abort them, you know, before they were born, you know, let them be in poverty, let them get into crime, let them get into drugs, let them get into all kinds of things. And you see this throughout the world, increasingly even in America. Mm-hmm. You know, you're having the drug crisis, you're having the unemployment crisis, you're having the video game crisis.
Right.
So the young generation needs role models. They need somebody to get in their life and pull them out of there, give them a job, give them a purpose, give them a direction in life. It's not time for you to kick back.
It feels like there's a real paradigm shift that I see taking place with some Christian leaders who I'm friends with. When our pursuit is material things, when we're left with being enamored with the next glitzy bauble that we configure, then that becomes what drives us. You know, what I've tried to challenge, you know, some of the most successful friends that I have who are very financially able, joy rarely comes with the next fancy thing, whether that's the next fancy sports car or the third home or whatever that is. Yeah. When we recognize what it is to give, when we recognize what sacrificial giving, like very Old Testament versus New Testament, that if 10% is kind of that baseline, what does it look like to give 30%, 40%? And I have really truly two close friends right now who have just made it a point that they're actually downsizing their life at the same point that they are unbelievably successful, just making stratospheric wealth. Mm-hmm. But they're downsizing their life because their whole goal is to give differently. I've got a friend right now, and his pursuit in life is to reverse tithe. Mm-hmm. And I have never seen him happier. I've watched him through chapters of his life where he has had some fancy cars, some fancy homes, and they didn't bring him satisfaction. Right now, he and his wife are in a pursuit of, they want to be able to live on 10% and give 90%.
Bless them.
But I've never seen him more passionate about his career. I've never seen him more passionate about developing young leaders. I've never seen him more passionate about his family. And he is, like, really and truly, he is on fire in every area of his life. The reason is that he stopped thinking about himself.
Right.
The pursuit isn't self. The pursuit is to fulfill the calling that God put us here for.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
And that's such an easy distraction for talented people that you can lose track of that idea. You know. All right. So I have to, just because there's a gap in this story that I just have to back up on this. You prepare young leaders. I prepare young leaders. You know, ultimately I'm reading, just started into it, Our Leaders Born. Mm-hmm. Have you read this one?
No, I haven't.
Okay. And so I'm really intrigued. Like, permit me to just press rewind.
Please
here
do.
Just for a moment. I want to jump back to the 17-year-old Sebastian who is battling with some rebellion, but also purchasing your own butcher shop and starting your own business.
Right.
Where does that spark come from? Like, is that developed in us? Is that something that is just born? And if it's born, why is it not born to all? Like, have you gone back to looking at what is that God spark that places you on a trajectory that within a 7-year period, you're going from a kid owning a butcher shop to completing your first PhD?
Right.
What makes that happen?
Oh, that's a great question. So, as a Christian, I know that it is God behind the scenes. But you also see this with secular individuals, you know? So I think it's a combination, first of all, of DNA. I think that some people are born that way, you know? And I think everybody has the potential for greatness, just that greatness looks different to different people.
Sure, absolutely.
You know? So when you talk about entrepreneurs, you typically want to have somebody who's more of an extrovert, somebody who's willing to take risks, somebody who's willing to fail. So those are the major trademarks of entrepreneurs.
Sure.
But I think excellency is found everywhere. So I think that it starts with the DNA that God places in them. And then comes the opportunities. You know, I call them lemons. Right? Because typically we think opportunities as something very positive right. that happens to you. Unfortunately, a lot of the positives do not generate greatness. Mm-hmm. And this goes back to the issue of a lot of wealthy people that have kids and they're like, how can I motivate them?
Yeah. That's, they almost never replicate it.
That's
in the next
part
generation.
Of the problem.
Right.
So part of the problem is that if you grow up with having everything, you don't have that opportunity to spark.
Right.
You know? So typically, the problems, and it can be a disease, it can be an accident. In my case, it was our father leaving us, which sort of just ignited me and said, all right, I got to do something about this, you know? So that's what sets you off. That's what triggers something like that. And then the last thing, and this is the most powerful one, are the choices that each and everyone makes. So again, I believe that God created human beings with the free will to choose. Mm-hmm. We choose to be miserable, we choose to be successful. The difference is the choice that we make. So that's when we have to exercise our will. Unfortunately, most people make choices subconsciously or unconsciously. They don't even know what they're choosing. So they're choosing to be poor, or they're choosing to be so on and so forth without really choosing it, because they're not conscious of it, because mm-hmm. they're not reading the books, because they're not talking to the people. So looking back at my own life, it was certainly the grace of God, but it was also my choices. And those choices, they carry a lot of sacrifices with them. Mm-hmm. Being willing to wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning, being able to work very hard, being able to finish that PhD dissertation. So I see it in the way I'm teaching it. It's a humanly divine combination. It's a partnership. It's 100% of God, because God gives you the opportunities, God gives you the DNA, and it's 100% of you. It is up to you. What do you do with those opportunities? What do you do with those setbacks, with those lemons? Are you going to make lemonade, or are you going to let them make you bitter?
You know, interesting, there was a study done 10 years ago is when they did their full reporting, but it was a linear study that was 25 years long. It was out of Yale University. It was on this idea of the spark. Like, mm-hmm. where can you teach the spark, or is it just born, right? Where does this happen? And at Yale University, they were testing a lot of elementary age students, actually young elementary mm-hmm. age, first, second, third grade, putting them through several different academic tests, several different cognitive tests, several different reasoning tests. And then their purpose was to do a longitudinal study over the next 2.5 decades to then match out their scores on their success ratings. And they were basing success ratings off of career success. It wasn't just dollar signs, although dollar signs certainly played into it, right? So now you take these kids that are 7, 8, 9 years old, but now we're looking at them later on when they're 35 and 40. Pretty right. good indicator. Mm-hmm. Here's what they discovered, though. They did one test that they said that they determined was the best indicator of whether a young person would be successful later on in life. And the test was simple. You've probably seen it done before, but it's basically kids who are brought in one at a time, and they have 3 marshmallows on the table. You've seen this?
Yeah.
And you can have one marshmallow now.
Yes.
Or you can wait. And in some cases, it's only 5 minutes, 10 right, minutes. Right. If you wait 10 minutes, you can have 3 marshmallows. The kid that takes the marshmallow right off the front is not successful. The kid who's willing to wait to get the 3 marshmallows
right.
is successful. That is a better indicator of any else. Cognitive studies, any like linear progression studies. Whether you are willing to wait, whether there is any level of sacrifice.
Delayed gratification. But tell me, isn't that the essence of Christianity?
It is.
I mean, that when I read that study and right. I'm teaching it all over the place, I'm like, this is exactly what the Bible's about.
It's exactly what
you
it
know,
is.
You know, it's what Jesus embodies, you know. Right. You know, I mean, he was willing to sacrifice here and now
right.
for the then.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
The challenge, though, is when you're in a successful family, If there is no opportunity for your children to ever have delayed gratification, right. if they just receive everything that they want, you know, and I've worked with teenagers before who have, like, you know, a monthly budget of $3,000 or $4,000,
right,
you
right.
know, they've yeah. got all the credit cards that they need, they've got purchased cars. those kids almost never reach the level of success. Almost never.
Unfortunately.
Because they've never learned delayed gratification. They've never learned the idea of sacrifice.
Exactly. Hard work and the other ones.
Fascinating, right? I mean, just to be able to ponder that out and to be able to understand what does that look like. And also to, sometimes I think, for myself, I think sometimes I make the educational process so complex when sometimes there's some simplicity to it that could make a huge impact on what we're doing, you know. All right, I'd love to chat with us about a few different issues. One, you've experienced as a young person communism. You've understood what it is to have capitalism. A large portion of your life is trying to figure out what that balance is. And then how does God play into that?
Right.
And so when we look at what's taking place on our on the world stage right now, how are you seeing that idea of the governmental philosophy being tied into countries and their people? And I know this is a huge question.
Yes, we probably
need another 2-3 hours just to even scratch it. But I'd love to just get your initial thoughts on that.
Yeah, so I'm going to be speaking on this very topic at a conference. So I did a little bit of research. I'm not through with it yet. But so when you look at human beings, the way God created us, we are meant to worship something. Okay. So in the Old Testament, you had the idols. So the Israelites were always tempted to worship the idols because the idols were being very attractive to the flesh. Mm-hmm. You know, there was promiscuity in there. There was partying there, things like that. So the God of the Bible says, no, only worship me, and me worshiping entails sacrifices.
That's right.
So we bring this into the 20th century or 21st century, and the question is, what's the God of our age? What's the idol of our age? Now, obviously, most modern people do not go into a temple and bow down to some statue because we think we're way beyond that. However, when you look at the God of our age, especially in Western Europe and in America, it tends to be the government.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, whatever problems we're having, whatever issues we're struggling, well, the government should do, or and typically we don't even say it quite that complex. We say somebody ought to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And that typically means that wouldn't it be nice if the government would set up a new department, hire some new people, put some new buildings to take care of this particular problem, you know? Now, again, I'm not against government. Mm-hmm. I have a second PhD in public administration, mm-hmm. so I understand how the government works. There's definitely room for it. God allowed it according to Romans. So even if it's an evil ruler, the ruler is allowed by God. But good governments are a reward from God to his people. Bad governments are a form of punishment. But as I'm looking throughout the world, people still have that 19th and 20th century mindset where they're going to worship government. That's, in a sense, what socialism and communism is.
Sure.
The government's going to come in, and the government's going to solve all my problems. They'll take care of everything, so on and so forth. The twist that we're having, and I think a lot of people are not aware of this, is that governments are becoming a lot more efficient. You know, and I was reading a documentary once about what would it be like if the Nazi regime under Hitler would have the tools that the Chinese regime has today in China? Mm. So imagine today there's over 100 million cameras where people's every move is being monitored and people know about it. There is technology that can literally read people's eyes and almost guess their thoughts. So imagine if Hitler, you know, would have ran those cameras, mm-hmm. you know, to his people and see exactly who's going to be the next would-be assassin or things like that. So that's the scary part. The scary part, and especially coming out of China, is that the Chinese communist government is embracing technology and is using technology so they can be more efficient, so they can subdue people better. The problem remains the fact that we see government as our idol. That's our modern day idol, and the government is becoming very powerful. So I draw the analogy with the Tower of Babel. When you see people coming together under a strong ruler, Nimrod, and this person said, we're going to build a tower that is going to go all the way up to God. That's the ultimate objective of a godless government, whether it's in Europe, whether it's in Asia, or anywhere else. So I think this is the big danger that we have to watch out. The contrast to the government is the church. The church is a voluntary organization. People join it, people give freely, people volunteer their time. You know, they get together in a community and they solve a problem, they watch each other's kids, they mow each other's lawns or things like that. And that's the way God allowed it, where there's checks and balances in there, where there's accountability in there, there's voluntarism. The government has the power to constrain you, you know, to take your tax away, to force you to do certain things. And again, there's nothing wrong with government, but the government has to be kept in balance.
Interesting, like on this subject, when you were leading up to, you know, what are we worshiping? I thought for sure you were going to say materialism. Now, what's fascinating for me, so my wife and I, we just returned from Australia. Last week, I was speaking at a conference over there. And we compared that we just said even there aren't even as many stores. There isn't the level of materialism.
Right.
Homes are still a normal size. It was fascinating for us to be in that context. We had the privilege to be in the UK a year and a half ago. And so we were through Greece and Italy and some different areas there. And we were saying the same thing, that there's such a different dynamic,
right,
that it feels like in a lot of most other countries, there is a reliance upon government that is different. In the US, there's this very independent mindset,
right,
that is so based on materialism.
Right.
And they're trying to figure out how to not have the government involved, you know? I mean, it's such a fascinating dichotomy that we see from a national perspective, country to country. You go to Scandinavian countries and there's a very different tone there,
right,
among the idea of governmental involvement, but there it's not negative because there's so much benefit to the citizens. Fascinating to see this idea. And then how do we then tweak or modify the application of the gospel to each of those environments?
Right.
You know, do you find that you have to change that, because you speak all over the world, do you feel that you have to change that message or that model to adapt to a national acclimation?
Well, I think that, the gospel is one and only, and I think it's applicable to every environment. But as a communicator, as a preacher, you do have to be mindful of the context that you're in. You have to be mindful of what are their general temptations, what are their general struggles, and speak from the scripture to the issues that they're struggling with. What's really, because something that's happening in Atlanta, Georgia, is not happening in Boston.
Right.
It's not happening, sure, in Romania. It's not happening in London. So the context, the situation, and I think that's the job of a preacher. The job of a preacher,
absolutely,
is to take the gospel and apply it.
Right.
You know, Billy Graham used to say you preach with a newspaper and the scripture in each hand. So you marry the two. You
right,
put them together. So you come up with a Bible solution to the issues that the newspaper talks about.
Right.
And that's very much the way you're supposed to apply the gospel to solve people's problems.
You know, you see Paul walk into the city and there's the temple to the unknown,
yes,
God. And that's what he's doing.
That's how,
right,
he's started
taking the context, yes, and saying, yeah, I know this God, let me tell you about,
exactly,
him, right?
Yeah.
So he's taking the societal context,
right,
and applying the truth of the gospel,
exactly,
into that setting as well. All right, totally different yet similar subject. We started chatting a little bit about China. The idea of if Hitler had the context, the technological context of China. I mean, really, I'm gonna spend some real time after the show really pondering that. But I do want to just ask your perspective, where you're living in the world of business, and yet you're applying it through the biblical worldview lens of Christianity, which I love. Mm-hmm. What do you think about the impact of AI? And how AI is already changing our world, how AI will change our world, and what are some of the areas where we as believers need to be prepared?
Yeah, that's again, I don't want to sound like a prophet, but I think AI is going to be the single greatest force, at least for the next 10 years. You know, something else may come along, but AI is sort of the new phenomenon, the new electricity of the the 21st century. It's already impacting us. I mean, you see the way we're relying on Google Maps just to get from point A to point B. And most importantly, the way we're being profiled. So right now, the average person, the average American, fuels AI through those two issues. You know, every time I go online, Google has my profile. They know kind of like my preferences, what it's Facebook.
And they're listening to us.
Exactly. Yeah, right. So everything is being captured. It's being processed. And then they come back to us with offers. Amazon's doing it. So everybody else is doing it. Now that,
right now being applied through consumerism.
Exactly. We in Romania, this is an interesting story that your listeners may not know about. We had a presidential election last year, okay, which was annulled by the Supreme Court. And it was the biggest case of cyber attack on a NATO country in our history. And here's what had happened. Apparently, the Russians, they had a number of bots, I mean, hundreds of thousands of these fake accounts, which were established by bots, which were sleeper accounts, you know. So 2 weeks before the presidential election, okay, these bots sort of woke up, okay, and they started supporting, through a grassroots movement, this no-name candidate for the presidency, which going into the election had about 5% of the vote.
Wow.
Okay, and through the impact of their influence, because they had a lot of people profile, because the algorithm knew exactly what people's preferences were, they started feeding them all kinds of fake news. They started feeding them all kinds of things. In a matter of 2 weeks, they were able to sway the election and get that individual 23% of the vote, okay? Wow. Fortunately, all this became public. The FBI, US FBI got involved, and they all, you know, showed this. They went to the Supreme Court, and Supreme Court said, yep, this is interference from a foreign government. We're going to annul the election. So this is the power of artificial intelligence, you know, that knows you. You know, it has the ability to create content a lot cheaper and a lot better than human beings. So if I have a big enough budget and I want to promote a lie, I can do it. You know, I can do it through fake videos. I can do it through fake text. And I can just keep on producing, just keep on producing. So artificial intelligence is huge, not to mention the fact that artificial intelligence has the ability, and it most likely will, destroy jobs. So we're talking about truck drivers.
Right.
We're talking about professors, teachers. We're talking about, you know, probably even some medical
physicians,
people
that
are just going to be replaced by artificial intelligence. And again, as a business person, I celebrate that because this is what technology has been doing for the last 300 years. You know, the farmers 300 years ago are being replaced by the combines. You know, the factory workers are being replaced by the robots. The big question, this is where my calling is for Christian, is we need to use artificial intelligence through entrepreneurship to create the jobs of the future.
That's right.
We need to be involved. One of the things that we need to remember is that AI, as of now, whether we know it or not, has a bias, the bias of the programmer. There is somebody who's writing that code, that algorithm. Unfortunately, a lot of them are not Christians. So you do have this bias. As a matter of fact, I'm working with a group out of Nashville, Tennessee, who's a book publisher historically, and now they are looking to write software and AI books and chats and things like that that have a Christian biases. So they're trying to get Christians, and we're probably going to collaborate with them with some of our graduates. We have an IT program. So they're trying to get Christians to be involved in writing the algorithm. So it has a Christian perspective on it, and it sort of limits the thing. But going back to the entrepreneurial piece, I believe that there's a tremendous opportunity for us to create jobs. And the jobs of the future are going to be the jobs that are social in nature.
Right.
You know, we will need lots of teachers. We will need theologians. We will need ethicists. You know, individuals, they'll be very good at technology. They'll be good in very good in ethics. We will need lots of people to do counseling. To teach people about work-life balance. We will need tour guides. I mean, the way we can get our kids away from their phones is by organizing walks in the park, all kinds of activities, all kinds of games. You know, in a sense, we have to go back to the 40s and the 50s and do things outside in nature. You know, we're experiencing now with, you know, printed books and printed documents just to counter the over-digitalization. And this is what I recommend all the parents, you know, for their kids. You know, every time you do not orchestrate an activity with your kids, their default position is going to be in front of their phone. Because that's just so attractive. That's right. Just so there. It's so easy to just start clicking away. So you have to be intentional. You have to be this community organizer. And who better to do this than Christians?
Right.
But we have to do it as businesses. That's so right. If we rely on them as volunteer organizations, I think we're going to have a limited runway.
Right.
But if we do them as social enterprises, where you know we raise capital for it, we charge for this, we have professionals, whether it's in teaching, whether it's in discipleship, and as Christians, we really should lead the way of people surviving in the digital age. Mm-hmm. I think it's a huge opportunity us to take artificial intelligence and make it work for us. Not to mention sharing the gospel. I mean, we have the possibility through artificial intelligence, and I'm working with a group out of San Antonio, a big evangelist who is doing a lot of Bible teaching, Bible lessons online. And he has students from Iran. He has students from India. He has students from all over the place that are logging into his courses and his classes. They're being discipled. They're being evangelized. That's the kind of tools that we need to develop as Christians, and we need to take advantage of that. Think of what would it be like for your students if you have an opportunity, and again, this is with their consent and their parents' consent, that every single week they would come in and they would give you last week's digital footprint. And would allow you as a mentor to see exactly how many hours they spend on Netflix, what did they watch on Netflix, how many hours did they spend on Instagram, what did they watch on Instagram. It's a great accountability tool. Because guess what? Big tech knows all that information.
That's right.
And they're using that information to manipulate them and to sell them more junk. You as a Christian...
And to sell an agenda.
Exactly. Right. And exactly. You as a Christian educator, along with their parents, along with their church and their pastors, you can have a sit down and say, look, this is exactly what your preferences are. This is what your temptations are. This is what we recommend you do. This is what the way you should fill your time. This is, you know, you should go to choir practice. You should join a handbell choir. You should do a sports. Maybe you should do some swimming. You should organize some going to the park with the kids. You should do some running, because I'm looking at you and I'm seeing a very good mirror of your behavior. You know, in the past, we used to say that somebody's character is determined by how they spend their money and their time.
That's right.
Now we know, because all we have to do is just take their phone, and the phone's going to tell us how many minutes did they spend on what applications, so on and so forth. So as Christians, we can use that as accountability tools.
You know, it's interesting right now, where there are some Christians who just are kind of throwing their hands up and saying, you know, wow, our world is getting increasingly dark. And they have a very negative perspective. I personally feel, and I can tell that you feel the same way.
Absolutely.
I feel like we're living at one of the most exciting periods in history. Are many areas becoming, or frankly, in the case of the UK and whatnot, already post-Christian? I think they are.
Yeah.
But the truth of the matter is that the gospel is still the bright light of the world.
Absolutely.
And the darker things are, the brighter our light shines.
Exactly.
And that it gives us a platform for really understanding how we use what we're trying to do through really taking the calling of Christ, making sure that that's applied in the real world. How do we take that to the real world?
Absolutely.
Through this next generation.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's ultimately the challenge for our lives.
Sure.
You know?
Sure.
Sebastian, it has been such a pleasure to have you on today. This has been a very fast hour that has gone by, but it has been such a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you.
I wish you all of the best. Thank you for being on the front lines of really and truly training up this next generation in the way that they should go, and it's a blessing to have you here.
Thank you very much for having me. God bless you.
God bless. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Joy of Leadership podcast. Living in the center of God's will is a rare blessing in today's day and age. Help us share this vital story of passionate leadership. If you would like to comment on the show, or if you know someone who would be a perfect guest, contact us at thejoyofleadership@gmail.com. If you like the show and don't want to miss a single episode, make sure you subscribe on your favorite podcast platform.